Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Welcome along this Saturday afternoon. Thank you for joining me, Justin Briley, for Unbelievable between now and 4:30, whether you're listening online or this Saturday afternoon on Medium Wave, on DAB or some other means. Welcome along. It's great to have you with me. An exciting programme for you today. It's again a Christian and non-Christian joining me in the studio. Not so much, though, as it were, to discuss their different faith perspectives, but different perspectives on the Bible, on the New Testament, specifically on the Gospels.
You're unbelievable.
So we're asking today things like, are the Gospels that tell the story of Jesus the result of many years of Chinese whispers with little relationship to the facts, as many claim in modern scholarship, or are they eyewitness testimonies set down within the lives of those who walked with Jesus? Well, that is the way it is, according to New Testament expert Richard Borkham, who joins me on the programme today. His book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, has more or less revolutionised scholarly study of the Gospels. He's joining me on the programme today in conversation with James Crossley, who's a New Testament scholar. He'll be arguing against some of the conclusions that Richard has drawn in his book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. It's a special two-parter. We'll be continuing the discussion next week as well. Let's meet our guests here on the programme today. Well, I've been really looking forward to the programme that we're going to be having today, as I'm joined by my guests Richard Borkham and James Crossley. They're both New Testament historians. They've both done a lot of work in the area of the Gospels and who they were written by, why they were written, what the context was that they were written into. And we've got a fascinating discussion on the programme today as we specifically look at Richard Borkham's really increasingly well-known book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And, well, Richard's here in person to tell us a bit about it. James is also here as he engages with Richard during the course of the programme today. So thank you, gentlemen, both for coming into the programme. Great to have you with me.
Thank you.
Perhaps we'll introduce you first, Richard, as a newcomer to the programme. Though I have to say, your name has been mentioned a number of times before in this very studio, as people, when they've come in to talk specifically about New Testament issues, and particularly things like the reliability of the Gospels, your name's cropped up on an increasingly frequent basis. And a lot of it is to do with this book that you've written. But first of all, tell us a little bit of yourself. What's your background, faith-wise, and as far as the way you got into this whole area of discipline?
I'm an Anglican by background. Grew up an Anglican. I actually began as a historian. I did a first degree in Cambridge in history. I did a PhD in history in Cambridge. And after that, moved into theology and biblical studies. I was 15 years in Manchester teaching historical and contemporary theology. I moved to St. Andrews as professor of New Testament. I was 15 years in St. Andrews. And 2 years ago, I took early retirement so that I could concentrate on the writing.
And you've kind of caused a bit of a stir, really, in what you have written. I mean, have you kind of gone in with the intention of making big grand claims that are going to kind of cause a bit of controversy?
No, not really. I think I develop my ideas for my own interest. I'm often more critical of what's out there in the consensus than a lot of people are. I want to test things out for myself. In the case of Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, I had some ideas which I knew would throw a spanner in the works. But I started it intending to write a much shorter book, which would throw these ideas out for people to, you know, give a bit of attention to. I ended up writing a much bigger book because the argument just led me there. And it was a very nice experience of writing, in a sense, that the argument sort of grew organically. And I just went where the argument took me. And it ended up as a 500-page book, which broke with the consensus in gospel scholarship, I think, a good deal more than I had originally intended when I set out.
And has been afforded the honour of the Ramsay Prize recently.
Yes.
I mean, what does that mean to you to have won that prize?
Well, it is quite a prestigious prize, awarded every 2 years across the board theological religious subjects. So it's an honour. It's also, I think, very good in terms of getting the book known. It's good publicity in the sense that I think people who may not follow what's coming out in the theological world have their attention drawn to it. And that, I think, is the intention of the prize, really, to highlight something that's worthy of people's attention.
Well, we'll get to the meat of what claims the book essentially makes in a moment. But let's first of all say hello again to James Crossley, who was with us for a couple of programmes back in January. James, great to have you with us again.
Yeah, good to be back again.
Thank you. You're resident in Sheffield, where you are you teach New Testament history and that sort of thing. You were in earlier in the year to this programme to talk about the book you authored with James Bird. How did early Christianity begin? Or how did Christianity begin? Was the title. And so, you yourself though don't actually come from a faith background. I mean, perhaps I think as we said before, relatively rare breed in that sense. Most people who are interested in New Testament church history tend to be Christians. But for you, it was really just interest in the subject that attracted you.
Yes, I mean, a series of accidents and things. I mean, I came from a fairly, well, entirely religious kind of background, and got into New Testament studies through somebody recommending for me to do A-level because I wanted to do ancient history and it was the nearest thing, and I really stuck with it all the way through university, enjoyed it immensely, and you know, really there was no other way I was going to go, I don't think, in the long run, and then kept going at PhD at Nottingham. And I've worked at Exeter and now at Sheffield, where I've been for 5 years teaching biblical studies.
I know that one of your special interest subjects has been Mark, the Gospel of Mark, and that's certainly something that crops up in Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. I mean, obviously, all the Gospels are packed with claims to the miraculous. I mean, now, as a non-Christian, does that sort of, in any sense, make a difference, do you think, to the way you look at the text compared to, say, a Christian who might be happy to believe that these miraculous events actually did take place, and so that therefore maybe colours the way they read the text themselves?
I mean, certainly. I could hardly claim that I read an ancient text, see something miraculous in the text, and think, well, you know, my almost natural instinct is to think, not a chance. So there is inevitably that kind of perspective coming through, but you still have to, you know, disprove or prove to the best you can these kinds of things. I mean, as we've said before, I mean, this is one of the areas where I might disagree with Richard's book, is the implications. Do we have eyewitnesses to miracles? Because this could be, this is a revolutionary claim, it seems to me, if you push the logic of Richard's argument.
Well, we'll get into that argument then. And really, let me say from the outset, if you haven't read the book, it's well worth picking up. I mean, you can find it on Amazon. I've put a link with this show if you want to click directly through and order a copy of the book. It's a pretty weighty tome, as you said, Richard. You weren't intending on writing such a long book, but I suppose the arguments just continued to fall out of the research you were doing. I mean, fascinating stuff. Just reading one chapter in isolation is a very interesting thing. There was a chapter on the names, the popularity of certain names around the time of Jesus, and you kind of draw out from these correlations, etc., with the Gospels and the number of times certain names are mentioned, the fact that this is good evidence for these Gospels having been produced, written in a certain time period at a certain place. Just fascinating stuff for me, but this is just one of the aspects. Tell us, what is the core, if you like, argument that you're setting forth in Jesus and the Eyewitnesses?
The core argument is very simple, or the core conclusion is very simple. It is that the Gospels, as we have them, the texts of the four Gospels in the New Testament, are pretty close to the testimony of the Eyewitnesses. I think in one case, the Gospel was actually written by an eyewitness, a disciple of Jesus. I think in the other three cases, we are pretty close to the way the eyewitnesses told their stories. I think some people listening in may find that not in the least surprising, because, of course, that has been traditional Christian view down the centuries. But it's not been the consensus view, or I should say at least the mainstream view, in New Testament scholarship during the past century at least. So in that sense, it's breaking with a whole lot of scholarly assumptions and methods designed to, as it were, get back behind the Gospels to the real Jesus. And the movement known as form criticism, which started up in the early 20th century, has had a huge impact on New Testament scholarship, which has been waning recently. I mean, I'm not entirely on my own in being dubious about form criticism, but it still has quite a hold over a lot of the ways in which people think, in which scholars instinctively go about working on the Gospels.
Is that then essentially a very, if you like, sceptical view that this could be first-hand information, that this in some way has to be the result of a sort of a Chinese whispers almost effect, stories circulating and changing over time until they finally end up in the way we read them?
The form critics argued that no doubt the eyewitnesses were the first people to tell stories about Jesus or to relate sayings of Jesus. They started the tradition off. But according to the form critics, the traditions then went through a fairly lengthy period of oral transmission in the Christian communities, and all kinds of things could have happened in that period. And they came out of that, as it were, simply as Christian community traditions attributed to the community, not to any individuals like Peter or John or whoever. And the evangelists pick them up at the end of that long oral tradition. Now, it is possible to read that model of the history fairly conservatively. I mean, quite a lot of people have done. They've argued that the early churches preserved these traditions fairly faithfully. The major form critics did not think that. They thought that the traditions were very heavily modified and in many cases created in the oral tradition. And one of the ways they worked was to say, how would a story of this kind, shall we say a miracle story, how would it have functioned in Christian teaching? And they correlated a particular sort of story or saying of Jesus with the functions it would have had, the way people would have used it in preaching and teaching in the church. And their idea was that that use had a very strong effect on the way the stories were told or indeed invented. So the model doesn't have to be very radical and sceptical, but it can also be very radical and sceptical.
Mm. And so what you're proposing, though, is very much at odds with what has been the predominant way of approaching, if you like, scholarly interpretation of Scripture. And you're saying, actually, form criticism has been overdone, and actually, there's a lot going for the Gospels in terms of just reading them as actual eyewitness testimony that hasn't been handed down through lots of oral transmission over years.
Yes, indeed. I mean, a very simple point is that the eyewitnesses were still around for this period that the form critics, correctly, there is a period between, shall we say, the death of Jesus and the earliest written Gospels. But it was a period in which the eyewitnesses were around. I mean, a very good case of this, just to sort of introduce the idea, is when Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, that's the earliest account we have of resurrection appearances, and Paul just gives a list of well-known people, disciples of Jesus, to whom Jesus after the resurrection appeared, and he says at one point, and he appeared to over 500 believers, most of whom are still alive. He's writing 20 years after the crucifixion. And that comment, 500, most of whom are still alive, I mean, that must imply, check it out with those people if you doubt it. It must imply that people like that were around in the early churches, they were available. And it also shows, I think, the kind of eyewitnesses that would be available. Because it seems to me you would have some eyewitnesses, like most of those 500, I guess, who are eyewitnesses to one or few incidents in Jesus' story. But you would have others who are kind of with Jesus continuously, someone like the Apostle Peter. So you have sort of minor eyewitnesses who might simply tell the story of their own encounter with Jesus. And then you would have the more official witnesses, the 12 apostles, but others too in that category of sort of disciples of Jesus right through the story.
And you make the case right from the beginning of the book that the fact that in these types of historiographies, having the eyewitnesses still present when they were written down was important. You referenced Papias a lot, and the way that what we have of his writings shows that he saw this as very important to having the testimony of eyewitnesses to hand if he was going to write certain things down. So as far as you're concerned, we need to see what was happening at the time historically and see that this was not just a sort of as much of a random and slightly haphazard affair as many people have kind of assumed in modern day thinking.
Yes. I mean, one interesting thing about this, is that ancient historians, people who wrote history in the ancient world, thought that, strictly speaking, you could only write contemporary history. I mean, they wrote about the more remote past, but they were entirely dependent on previous historians. If you're going to be a creative historian to tell a new story, it's got to be contemporary because you've got to be able to contact the eyewitnesses, actually meet the eyewitnesses, quiz them, as it were, so that you get some idea of their reliability and that kind of thing. So direct testimony from the eyewitnesses was the ideal. The ideal, in fact, was that the historian himself should have been an eyewitness and involved in the events. But failing that, he should be in contact with eyewitnesses. So I think that the Gospels, being very obviously contemporary history, that is within the memory of living people, would readers of the Gospels, hearers of the Gospels, would have expected eyewitness testimony to be included in the Gospels. And so they'd be alert for indications of who the eyewitnesses were. And that's, I think, a big point, actually, because part of what I want to argue is the Gospels do have ways of indicating their eyewitness sources, which few people have really recognised. And some people in response to me say, you know, these are very vague and ambiguous references. But I think the significance of the references is much increased if you put yourself in the position of the original hearers, who would be expecting eyewitness testimony and would be alert to indications of it.
I mean, for instance, you talk about the story of the road to Emmaus and the fact that only one of the disciples is named, and that seems rather odd. Why would you go to the trouble of naming one but not the other? And you've said in your book that it's actually when you do get a name, you've got to ask, well, what's going on there? Is that for a particular reason that someone's been named? And in that instance, you would say this is the eyewitness that the writer was depending on for that particular story.
Exactly, yes. I mean, I think certain eyewitnesses would have been well known in the early church as the people who witnessed this or that story. In that particular case, the man's called Clopas. And you see, there's a phenomenon of names in the Gospels, which I think requires some kind of explanation. One is not surprised that major disciples of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, Peter, should be named. That's not at all surprising. But if you look at the minor characters in the Gospels, the people who just appear in one or two episodes, most of them are anonymous. Most of them do not have names. But then we find a handful of them in each of the Gospels do have names. So why does Luke name Clopas? Why does Luke name Zacchaeus the tax collector? Why does Mark name Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus? Bartimaeus, again by Mark. Why have we got these few names? And I think really the only suggestion that accounts for pretty much all of these instances, and therefore it's a kind of economic hypothesis, is that these are people who subsequently joined the Christian communities and were well known for telling these stories. You know, I imagine Bartimaeus as a member of the Jerusalem church, you could hardly stop him telling his story on any possible occasion, you know. And therefore the story came with his name attached to it.
And so for those who were, as you say, in that community reading those stories, these names would have meant something. So they were only being included where there was obviously, meant to be seen as so-and-so who you've probably heard of at some point.
Yes, indeed, or so-and-so whom you've met. Yeah. Because another feature of the early churches was there's a great deal of travelling around and movement and so on. So I think one should imagine quite a few of these eyewitnesses cropping up here and there in the early Christian movement and being really quite widely known.
Well, before we come back to James for some comment on that, let me say, if you're listening and you want to find out more, don't forget Richard's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, is available to buy. I've put a link to it on the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can download this programme there as a podcast, and indeed many others of a similar nature that you may be interested in. Do check through the archives there. You can also get in touch if you'd like to get in touch with anything you hear in the programme today. Do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. The phone line also available if you wish to leave a voicemail message, 08456 52 52 52, and select option 5.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, fascinating stuff. Let's bring James in at this point. James, I mean, you've said from the outset that you don't necessarily differ greatly in certain areas of the book to Richard's hypothesis. I mean, how much would you say you do go by this form criticism form of looking at the Gospels and understanding them in that way?
Well, I was actually one of the sceptical people about form criticism Richard alluded to. I've long felt it was never sufficiently explained with reference to cross-cultural data or to ancient historical sources. I was always quite sceptical about form criticism. I mean, in certain cases, I can see how individual stories may have developed and how they may reflect the concerns of the church, certainly. But as an overall kind of grand model for the gospel texts, I'm very sceptical. I was always one of the types of people who was there to be convinced by a theory of eyewitnesses as well, but I came at it from a different angle in many ways, through kind of a classic historical Jesus scholarship approach, where, for example, I did a lot of work on Jesus and the law, where it seemed to me that this material had to be at least very, very early, probably reflecting historical Jesus as far as we can show something like that. For example, if you have a dispute over plucking of the grain in Mark 2:23 through to 28, or hand-washing disputes in Mark 7, I mean, this is the kind of material that's not much relevance at all, it seems to me, to the early church, but exactly the kind of disputes you get in a kind of, let's say, intra-Jewish legal dispute or something like this. So that had to come from somewhere, and as Richard says, there are, you know, Peter and co were around in those decades. So the idea of eyewitnesses seemed very, very appealing to me. So, like I say, I mean, I'm as a theory, I think Richard's onto something. I agree with a lot of it. I would happily support most of it. I just can't go the full way. I still think there's a bit more chaos in the gospel traditions and something like John's gospel. But I think as a general model, you know, we all disagree on details and so on. I think it's got a lot going for it.
Yeah, this is more or less preserved fairly well. I mean, perhaps your focus will be on the synoptic gospels, though, Matthew, Mark and Luke.
Mm. Yes.
And you would put John in a different category.
Yes.
And this is an area where Richard is perhaps most controversial in his book, and we'll come to that in a moment. But, I mean, do you feel then that scholarship is swinging in the direction of Richard? I mean, you obviously are also in a similar camp to Richard, if not agreeing in every aspect. But do you think that there is a bit of a reaction now to this more sceptical form criticism?
That's a very difficult question, I think, at the moment, because I mean, if we take a look at this in a more historical context, scholarship in historical context, I think Richard's book is a part of I don't mean this negatively or positively, a conservative movement in biblical studies, which is right there in the mainstream at the present. So N.T. Wright's book on the resurrection, Hurtado's book on Lord Jesus Christ, these have become prominent mainstream books, whereas in an era where form criticism was dominant, they were there, but not quite as prominent. But the other thing is, there's the alternative reaction. I think there's a hard secularising move in New Testament studies as well. So I think Richard's work will get, time will tell, of course, will get a lot of support in more conservative camps, but the hard secularising world, I could see, you know, reacting against it as well. And you can probably tell by the way I'm phrasing this is that I don't entirely agree that this is necessarily a good thing, that,
right,
you know, cultural contexts are dictating how we accept results or not. But that's my impression. That's all I can say, really, of how this will go. And but, I mean, there are exceptions. I consider myself an exception. Mm-hmm. So I certainly don't consider myself conservative. I have openly healthy secular tendencies in my eyes. But I think it's a. But I think it is a good model.
I mean, is there a bit of a split then between those who are, as it were, in a more conservative, if you like, manner of wanting to look at things? And again, is this a case of bias coming into play? I mean, I know when we last had you on, James, you did feel that. The willingness for evangelical scholars to accept the miraculous, the resurrection, and the theories that go around that for its proof, were not warranted, if you like, by just the arguments they put forward. I mean, Richard, does your faith background, as it were, has that been a motivator in driving you towards finding a certain conclusion that the Gospels are eyewitness testimony, that they do have this reliability, which obviously many evangelicals open with welcome with open arms, as opposed to something like the Jesus Seminar or something. So I mean, does your faith play a part in that?
I mean, it's really very, very hard to know quite what role one's own approach has in determining the conclusions you reach. I mean, clearly one's basic attitude to the religious significance of the material. I think that you can't get away from the fact that the material is of religious significance, and therefore many people who work on it have got some kind of interest in it beyond just an interesting bit of ancient history. I think in the end, it's the arguments that have got to be assessed as arguments. Mm. And in a sense, it doesn't really matter where someone comes from. It's the arguments that have got to be assessed. And I think there is a degree of objectivity in New Testament studies, as in most historical work. You can never get pure objectivity, and I shouldn't really imagine that one could. But there's an important degree of objectivity, I think, in the sense of arguments being put out there that anyone coming from any perspective can assess as arguments. And I think we do need to hold on to that, as opposed to, you know, the kind of relaxed postmodern perspective which says, well, you know, everybody's right, really, you know, and just how I feel is what counts. I think there are hard issues of arguments that can be discussed. I mean, if I could just go back to the reception the book's had, for a moment, because, I mean, I've had lots of reviews and responses that I've responded to, and responses go all the way, actually, from the wildly enthusiastic through to some people who absolutely hate the book, you know, and it's not surprising. In a sense, I'm proposing a sort of paradigm change, paradigm changes, you know, are never sort of totally one-off things. They're always prepared for. There are always elements leading in that direction that then have to be sort of gathered up, and, you know, here you've got a new paradigm. But paradigm changes are not easy to accept, and in a sense I don't think one should accept paradigm change easily. It should be subject to very, very serious discussion before you take it on.
And is that partially because what you're essentially proposing is what was traditionally believed in the first place, that it is eyewitness testimony and it is kind of fairly authoritative?
Yes, and I think the significance of the book in that sense is that while the conclusions are relatively traditional, the arguments by which I reach them are new. Mm. And that, I think, means that no one is justified in saying, well, this is just the old traditional stuff. We know all that. We've dismissed it. We know it's wrong, so we won't bother to read the book. The book doesn't rest on the traditional arguments. It has a whole lot of new angles on the gospel material.
We'll continue talking in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break here. We're talking about Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. It's by Richard Borkham. It's caused a stir in the world of biblical scholarship for its central claim that the Gospels are the testimony of eyewitnesses, and they have been transmitted quite faithfully. We're going to be getting into more of the arguments for that as we come back in a moment's time, but do join me again in a couple of minutes' time as we continue to look into this fascinating and engaging topic.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back. As we continue to look at Jesus and the Eyewitnesses with Richard Borkham and James Crossley. James, if you like, a non-Christian church historian, Richard Borkham coming from a faith perspective. But we're really looking at the arguments today as far as the conclusions that were drawn in Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, which won the Ramsey Prize for Christian Literature earlier this year. The claim is that these are the Gospels themselves actually are the testimony of eyewitnesses. In fact, fact, very much against the popular trend, Richard has concluded that the Gospel of John was written by the apostle, the disciple John. So we're going to be looking at that particularly in this section of the programme. Gentlemen, we've talked already around the issues surrounding the whole area of eyewitnesses and things. Richard, tell us specifically, what conclusions do you draw as to who the primary eyewitnesses in the three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke, who they actually are and why you think that's the person?
Yes, I mean, the earliest testimony outside the New Testament that we have to the origin of the Gospels comes from a man called Papias, who was a bishop in Asia Minor, modern Turkey, at the beginning of the 2nd century. And he was around at the time when the Gospels were being written. I think it's quite significant, and interested in these issues at the time when the Gospels were being written. And it's Papias who tells us that the Gospel of Mark was written by Mark, who worked as Peter's interpreter. Presumably he translated Peter's Aramaic into Greek or possibly Latin. And it was Mark who recorded Peter's teaching in a gospel. Papias thinks he tended to have individual stories from Peter, and the way they were put together was Mark's work. Now, I think there are all sorts of reasons, actually, for rehabilitating Papias in terms of his evidence on Mark's gospel. And I think it goes very closely with quite a lot of evidence within Mark's gospel that could also lead us in the same direction. So I think Mark's gospel is primarily largely based on the testimony of Peter. And one other point about that is that Mark himself, if he's the John Mark of the New Testament, I think there's a good argument that he is, he himself had been a member of the Jerusalem church. So he'd had a good deal of opportunity himself for meeting the eyewitnesses. So I think the main source from Mark is Peter, the way that Peter used to tell the stories in his public preaching. And Mark may well have thrown in some things he knew as well for himself. Now, I go along with the view of the large majority of gospel scholars that Mark's gospel was used by both Matthew and Luke, and both Matthew and Luke take over a great deal of Mark's material. Usually they abbreviate it somewhat, because I think Matthew and Luke are both interested in writing comprehensive gospels. You know, they want to gather up all the material they can find and squeeze it all into one gospel. So they had other sources as well. Luke, of course, is the most explicit of the evangelists in terms of telling us what he's doing, because Luke actually has a preface of the type that ancient historians would write. And he refers there quite specifically, I think, to his material coming from the eyewitnesses. So we have Mark's gospel, and Luke, I think, would have used Mark's gospel quite happily because he would have seen it as effectively Peter's testimony. Where does his other material come? I think we can't really do more than speculate about that. I think there's some grounds for thinking that some of Luke's traditions actually come from the circle of the women disciples, who are quite prominent in Luke's gospel. And the other feature of Luke's gospel I think that's rather interesting is that whereas for Matthew and Mark, you really get the impression that the disciples of Jesus are the 12. Very few references to other disciples of Jesus. In Luke, he's constantly telling us that great crowds of disciples travelled around with Jesus. There were a lot of other people around, and Luke names a number of these other people. So I think it's actually more likely that Luke has drawn, besides Mark, on material coming from perhaps less well-known eyewitnesses outside the circle of the 12. Matthew is the most puzzling of the Gospels, and I say the least about Matthew of any of the Gospels in the book. Papias connects it with Matthew in a rather contorted way that's quite difficult, I think, to follow. I think Matthew must have had something to do with the Gospel. And, of course, the title Gospel according to Matthew doesn't have to mean Matthew wrote it. It can mean that Matthew's, you know, an important figure behind it. I do think the titles of the Gospels must be very early, because if you think about it, as soon as an early Christian community had more than one Gospel, they had to have a way of distinguishing one from another. And we know of no other way in which the Gospels were ever titled. So I think these names attached to the Gospels must go back to the early circulation of the Gospels, when people were in a good position to know what titles should be given to the Gospels. In Matthew's case, I found it very... the reason I don't think Matthew himself could have written the Gospel is not only that does he take over Marx material very, very generously, but also when he records his own call as a disciple, if he were Matthew, when he records Matthew's call of a disciple, Matthew's sitting at the receipt of custom, famous story, mm-hmm. Jesus comes along and calls him away from his profession as tax collector. Matthew has actually taken over Mark's story. It seems to be very unlikely that Matthew...
The story of Levi.
Indeed, yes. It seems to be very unlikely that the Apostle Matthew would need to depend on Mark for the story of his own call. So that's the one thing that really convinces me that Matthew isn't the author of the Gospel.
Right.
But I think there's enough ground for thinking that Matthew's somewhere behind the Gospel. That's as far as I can go with Matthew.
Would you by and large agree with, on those synoptic Gospels, Richard's assessment there, James, that we can be fairly confident that the authorship, if not written by the maimed people, is firmly associated with the names that have traditionally been associated with those Gospels. And obviously in the case of Mark, Peter, being the principal eyewitness that Mark uses.
I would, but with qualifications, I think. I mean, I have, say, a more agnostic view in many ways. I see the arguments Richard laid out was certainly plausible. With Mark, I'm a little sceptical. I have no firm conclusion on this, but with Mark, there is the idea that it was a gospel not in order. There were certain problems with Mark's gospel, so I could see theoretically, I'm not saying this is necessarily true, that it could get attributed to somebody like Mark, who is a sort of flawed character in the New Testament, and by default with Peter in that way. So it gives it both the authority and it can account for the perceived problems with Mark in the early church. Now, I don't say that's the true account of what happened, but it leads me to be just a little sceptical on these things. I'm just more agnostic on the who wrote the Gospels more than anything, that's all.
With Mark, for instance, do you believe there was a single author? I mean, can we be sure of that much, that this was one person pretty much writing?
I don't think we can be sure of that much. I mean, multiple authorship certainly there in early Judaism. So, I mean, it's possible you could have more than one author, but it's also possible you could have a single author. I really don't know is the answer to that.
What makes you confident then, Richard, that it is a single author, more or less writing down the reminiscences of Peter?
I think he was doing a little more than writing down the reminiscences. You know, I think Mark is a real author. He puts together the material. And you see, Mark is doing something which, unless someone had written an account like Mark before Mark, which is possible, but Mark is the first person we know who actually had to put the traditions about Jesus and the sayings of Jesus into a sequence, into a chronological sequence, and tell the whole story of Jesus' ministry and death and resurrection. So Mark has to actually, he has to absorb this material into a source, into a sequence. And the way I think Mark has done it actually is really more pedagogical than chronological, you know. In other words, Mark has laid out the material so that we learn by following it. And the easiest point to illustrate this is that the miracles of Jesus in Mark almost entirely confined to the first half of the Gospel, up to Peter's confession. And then Jesus' predictions of the passion, the cross and resurrection, occur from that point onwards. So it's almost as though Mark is laying out the evidence for us as to who Jesus is. And first of all, he has all these deeds of power that impress everybody convince Peter that he's the Messiah. And then we have to learn that he wasn't necessarily the Messiah in the expected sense. So from that point onwards, Mark is leading up to the cross. Now, and there's more stuff like that. And I think Mark has arranged the material in that sort of way. That's why Papias thought it was not in order, and he meant, I think, not in chronological order. It's not in chronological order, but it is a carefully ordered sequence, which I think must have been done by a single author.
And so you don't have the problem that James does in terms of that not being enough evidence, really, for this being attributable to John Mark. Your point, to some extent, was it, James, that because of the nature of Mark, which has been traditionally seen as a bit possibly haphazard or something, that sort of reflects the character of Mark, and therefore that would be the reason it would be attributed to
him. I only raise it as a possibility, that leads to my agnosticism or scepticism about this, that's all. Again, as I say, I could see what Richard's arguing, and I could see it as a plausible explanation. I just can't go the whole way
yet. It just doesn't compel you.
Well, say something else about the derivation of it from Peter, because I think, in a sense, one could make a case for derivation from Peter, whoever the author was. Mm. And it's remarkable that Peter is so prominent in Mark. I mean, Peter, in proportion to the size, because Mark's the shortest of the Gospels, but in proportion to his size, Peter, who's a prominent character in all the Gospels, but in Mark, he's more prominent than any of the other Gospels, and he's, of course, much the most prominent figure after Jesus. And suppose people are listening to Mark being read or reading it for themselves, and they are alert to who the old eyewitness might be. The first of Jesus' disciples to be named in the Gospel is Peter. Really quite emphatically, he's called Simon, of course, at that point, but Simon, repeated in the first reference. And then there is Peter again in the last verse of the Gospel, virtually the penultimate verse, I think. Again, the angel says, go and tell Peter and Jesus' disciples. He didn't have said Peter, he could have just said. So that there's a special prominence of Peter, I think, in this very frequent naming of Peter all the way through the Gospel, and also his naming right at the beginning of the events of the Gospel and right at the end, forming a sort of enclosure around the whole narrative, which I think could lead very easily to, if one is looking for eyewitnesses, Peter is the obvious eyewitness that Mark would be broadly dependent on.
So you'd say, really, the Gospel of Mark is really the Gospel according to Peter. It's just that Mark was the person attributed to having written it down. I mean, perhaps moving beyond the synoptics to the real area where you guys have most disagreement. John's Gospel. I mean, I've always understood this, you know, to be, you know, the first three Gospels sort of tell the history, and then John's Gospel is in a different category where it's really a theological interpretation of Jesus's life and ministry. Now, is that the way you would see it, James? That John sort of is a different type of material to the others.
It's been criticised, that kind of view, obviously, but I think there's some truth in it. I mean, the big problems for me with regards to Richard's theory is something, take the raising of Lazarus, for example, as the catalyst for Jesus' death, whereas with synoptics we've got the cleansing of the temple, or some of the very ferocious disputes on Jesus claiming equality with God in John 5, John 10, and why these aren't in the synoptic gospels. I mean, this is where I start to disagree with Richard's theory, perhaps, but let's just assume there was an eyewitness behind John's Gospel, we've still got those problems there. How do we deal with those? It seemed to me stark differences between the two Gospels. And then what if all is eyewitness, what does this tell us about the process of eyewitness testimony?
So you believe John basically says quite different things about Jesus to the synoptics. I mean, the Christology that is in John is simply not present, as far as you're concerned, in the synoptic Gospels. They don't have as high a view of Jesus as John.
Certainly
John
not
has.
As vigorously developed. And why does this material not turn up in the synoptics? I mean, presumably, if there were the disputes such as John 5, where it was the Sabbath and the Jews want to stone Jesus because of his claims for equality with God, why do these not turn up? Because it seems these would be very prominent
significant
stories.
Episodes, yeah. Okay. Well, you claim, Richard, that John is actually, ironically, out of the four Gospels, the one that is written, not just an eyewitness account of, but written by the eyewitness.
Yes.
So what's your claim for that?
See, oddly enough, John is the only Gospel that quite explicitly claims to be written by an eyewitness. But for most modern scholars, it's the one least likely to be written by an eyewitness. So it's kind of ironic in more than one way, if you like. I think that one should take the statement seriously. And I think that really there are only two possibilities in reading that note at the end of John's Gospel, which says this is the disciple who wrote these things. And one possibility is that he really did. The other possibility is that he's falsely claiming to be that disciple. I don't think there's any way of making that statement mean anything else. A lot of modern scholars have wanted to try and take it to mean something less than it actually says. So I think that's really the stark choice. I do think, with James, of course, there is a sense in which John's Gospel is in a category of its own. It's distinctive by comparison with the Synoptics in various ways. But I think one of those ways is that it is a more reflective, a more interpretative Gospel. All the Gospels, of course, have some theological interpretation. This isn't an absolute contrast. And a point I frequently make in the book, actually, is that history is never uninterpreted. Fact and interpretation always go together in history. We can't avoid that. And we should never imagine ourselves getting back behind interpretation to some sort of uninterpreted core. It's not there. So there's interpretation in all the Gospels. But clearly, I mean, an interesting way of putting this is that if you think about miracle stories again, I think Mark has about 16 miracle stories in a very short Gospel. In a much longer Gospel, John has only 7. And miracle stories are very important in John. He's always talking about the signs, which are the miracles. He tells us these signs so that we may believe, he says at the end. They're very important to John, but he has far fewer of them. And he has far fewer, as it were, episodes than any of the other Gospels. And this, I think, is because he's been deliberately very selective and giving himself the space to expound on these events and to tell the stories at greater length. He's a good storyteller, but also to reflect on the meaning of the events. So I think that's one important difference for John.
With John, what's the evidence within the texts themselves that you particularly pick up on as being? I mean, he talks a lot about the beloved disciple, and that's traditionally been taken as a self-reference of the author. And you don't feel that sort of can be removed from the person who wrote the Gospel itself. It has to be John.
I think it has to be because the note at the end of the Gospel. And one other thing about my view of John's Gospel is I see it as a very carefully composed, very integrated work, not a sort of process of editing of various sources thrown together rather awkwardly as some people see it. I think it can be shown in kind of literary terms that it's a very integrated work. And that means that when the last verse of the Gospel tells us that the beloved disciple wrote the things, then we have to take it to mean the beloved disciple who appears through the Gospel is the author. There's an odd thing, of course, about the anonymity of the beloved disciple, which I don't think anyone's explained fully satisfactorily, and I'm not at all sure I have a final conclusion on that. But I think one thing that the anonymity does is to sort of single out the beloved disciple and put him in a different category from Peter and John and Nathaniel and Nicodemus and the other disciples named in the Gospel. And just one more point that follows from that. If you do look at the other characters in the Gospel, the other disciples of Jesus in John, they are disciples who are not, for the most part, prominent in the Synoptics. So you get people like Nathaniel, who doesn't appear in the Synoptics at all. You get members of the 12 like Philip and Andrew, who in the Synoptics are just in the list of the 12, but you don't hear anything else about them. They're prominent in John. And I think John is a Gospel that comes, as it were, from the traditions of the beloved disciple and his circle of disciples of Jesus. So I think the traditions are coming from a different a circle of people from those that fed into Mark's narrative around Peter.
I mean, would John have been aware of Mark's Gospel? Do you think he would have read that and it would have influenced what he wrote, therefore?
Yes, I do think that John does know Mark's Gospel. He doesn't, it seems to me, use it as a source in the way that Matthew and Luke do. He doesn't take over chunks of Mark, except on special occasions, I think he may do, but on the whole, he doesn't. And he, I think, would have been able to presume that most of his readers would already know Mark. Mark had been circulating around the churches for a while before John wrote. And therefore, I think he can take Mark for granted, as it were, and he's doing much more in the way of supplementing Mark. You see, I think if you put Luke, Matthew and John together, they all know Mark, they all use Mark to some extent. And what Luke and Matthew are trying to do is to produce comprehensive Gospels that include all of Mark's stuff and a lot of other stuff too. John is writing a very selective Gospel, which takes Mark for granted, thinks you know that, and adds to it. So they're very different approaches to Mark.
Is that satisfactory for you, James, as an explanation of why there may be these fundamental differences that you see between John and the Synoptics?
Yes, I mean, I agree that there's something going on strange with the beloved disciple, and the best explanation is that there's an origin of this material with the beloved disciple, whoever the beloved disciple may be. Again, I think there's probably a general awareness of Mark's gospel behind John, and I think I agree with the model of, you know, this comprehensive model you've mentioned with reference to Luke and Matthew. I mean, I think it's where we probably differ would be where we go with that. And John's gospel, I've got no significant difference, if any, with the general outline that Richard gave.
I mean, you mentioned your problems, though, with the fact that episodes that seem so prominent in John and simply aren't touched on in the synoptics. I mean, does that make you think actually those things were a later addition? If they happened, they would have been recorded in those, in Mark at least, the very earliest.
Yes.
Testament.
Well, yes. I mean, some of them are. I mean, seem very extremely prominent episodes in John's Gospel, such as a dispute over the very nature of Sabbath, I think, and the you know, hard full deification of Jesus and the raising of Lazarus as well, leading to the death of Jesus. These seem to me to be examples. More probably to be creative rewriting. You know, I mean, yeah. I would take something like the cleansing of the temple to be the more plausible reason for the death of Jesus, which you don't get in John.
I mean, you do pick up on the death of Lazarus, the resurrection of Lazarus. It only happens in John, but surely such a extraordinary event would have been recorded in the synoptics. But you have a particular theory, don't you, Richard, as to why it might not have been mentioned in Mark, etc.
Yes, I think there's probably something that Gerd Tyson suggested. He calls it protective anonymity going on in the Gospel Passion narratives. And it's very interesting if you look at Mark's Gospel. And there's a great sort of cloak and dagger sort of feel to Mark's Gospel as he gets nearer to the arrest of Jesus. And people who are very prominent in that story appear anonymously. In itself, that's not so different from the rest of the gospel, but one of two cases. The woman who anoints Jesus in Mark's story, Jesus says she will be remembered wherever the gospel is told, you know, but she hasn't got a name. I mean, it's an extraordinary case of not naming someone, I think, and I don't think any of the commentators really have a good explanation of that. Tyson's suggestion is that people like that, the young man who runs away in the garden of Gethsemane in Mark, people like that are being protected because these stories were being first told in a context in Jerusalem where it would be dangerous to be known as one of those who had aided and abetted a false Messiah. And I think Lazarus could well be put into that category. In fact, John's Gospel actually says, soon after the raising of Lazarus, that the authorities were trying to arrest Lazarus too. So Lazarus was in danger.
And so what you're saying is when the Gospel of John came to be written, that was no longer a going concern.
Exactly.
They could sort of lift the self-imposed, you know, anonymity.
Yes.
How would he have actually known it was Lazarus, though? I mean...
Well, if he was the beloved...
Because he was the witness.
If he was the beloved disciple, yeah. He would have known Lazarus. He was in Jerusalem at the same time, yes. So I think, I mean, the general sense, I mean, I'm not bothered by a more general fact of there being material in John that is not in the synoptics. I mean, there's a lot of material in Luke that's not in Mark, there's material in Matthew that's not in, you know, you've got multiple traditions, nobody's writing, you know, a complete life of Jesus, they're selecting from the traditions they know, and I think coming from different circles of disciples is one way to explain the different events. I do agree that Lazarus is however a different case, because Lazarus is so important in the way the story develops.
Well, exactly, and that's really your fundamental point, isn't it, there, James, that you've got different reasons for Jesus being arrested and ultimately crucified in different Gospels, and so if they both claim to be eyewitness accounts, which one is the correct account? I mean, is that a...
I think so. I mean, and this is where I talk about, you know, the implications of Richard's argument. I mean, if on the one hand, does it mean we have creative rewriting, or does it mean we have something... Does this tell us something about eyewitness testimony itself? I mean, you talk about the gist in the book quite a lot, which seems, you know, a reasonable argument to me. But also, would something like this, if we took your argument about eyewitness writing in John's Gospel, would that say something different about the nature of eyewitness testimony?
Not quite sure what you mean there.
Well, it seems to me the gist is a bit different in both, if you see what I mean.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Well, when I use that term gist, I'm really talking about an individual story, you know. Mm. Say the story of the healing of Bartimaeus. We would expect someone retelling that story. And I actually have a whole chapter in the book on the psychology of eyewitness memory, which is actually a fresh contribution to this whole thing. I think, you know, there's a lot of study by psychologists, a lot of data we now have as to the kinds of things people remember well, how they remember well, and so forth. And it's a normal feature of telling, you know, if there's a story that's important to you, it's happened to you, and you go on telling it to people through your... You will vary the detail. People do vary details, but the gist is what remains constant. So I think you only have to set out the synoptic gospels in parallel, where they're talking about the same events, to see that they vary the details but retain the gist. I'm not so sure about, I think, James, you meant the gist of the whole story, as it were, in John being different. Just on that point of what led to Jesus' death, because it's a very significant issue, I think, in the whole story, as it were. I think the thing that happens, of course, is that the synoptics have the cleansing of the temple at the beginning of the week, beginning of Jesus' last week in Jerusalem. He arrives in Jerusalem and cleanses the temple. Whereas John has that right at the beginning of Jesus' public ministry. Now, really, that's, if you like, John against Mark, because Luke and Matthew have simply followed Mark. They're not additional witnesses to that. I think that what Mark has done is another way in which Mark is artificial, in a sense, in how he lays out the material. Mark has given everything that happens in Galilee. Then he has Jesus travelling to Jerusalem. Some things happen on the way. And then Mark has everything that happened in Jerusalem. So, in a sense, Mark has an artificial scheme. And he had to put all things that happened in Jerusalem in his last week, because that's the only place where his Jesus is, in Jerusalem. Now, John, you see, one of the things about John that's very striking, actually, is that John is very precise about chronology and geography. You always know in John pretty closely at what point in the two-year ministry something happens, because he ties things to the Jewish feasts. You always know pretty definitely where they happen, which much, much vaguer very often in the synoptics. John has this precision about history and geography, which makes me actually more inclined to credit John. And I'm not alone in this. I mean, I think quite a few people think that actually, if one's simply looking at general probability, it's much more likely that Jesus went to Jerusalem several times during his ministry than that he didn't go near the place until the last week. But the point I really wanted to make about what led to the death of Jesus is, you see, I think John portrays the cleansing of the temple as the beginning of this process of antagonizing the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem that eventually leads up to Jesus' death. So, in a sense, the cleansing of the temple is a trigger, even in John's narrative. Whereas what Mark does is condense that whole process that John has taking place over several visits to Jerusalem, that antagonism of the authorities to Jesus has to all kind of build up within 1 week. But I think actually they both give the cleansing of the temple an important role in that.
Well, join us again in a couple of moments' time when we'll hear from James again and start to wrap up this section of the programme. Well, if you've enjoyed the programme today as I have, you'll want to tune in next week as James and Richard join me again to continue to discuss Jesus and the eyewitnesses. So much more to uncover in this book. Specifically, we'll be looking at the testimony of eyewitnesses, how far that can be trusted in itself, given Richard's belief that it was, if you like, the testimony of eyewitnesses that was recorded in the Gospels. So join us for that as we continue to look into this subject. Let's get back into our discussion as we start to wind up our programme for today.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So, James, does Richard's explanation of the differences between John and the synoptics, particularly Mark, work for you? Giving a plausible reason why it could still be eyewitness testimony, even though it differs significantly from Mark, which, you know, essentially what you're saying is John got it, in terms of historically correct, because Mark wasn't so interested in getting everything in its perfect order. He wanted to put everything that happened in one place together in one one bit of the story.
Well, I mean, it stretches out a little bit too much for me, I think. I mean, I still think there is an element of a good chronology in Mark's gospel, especially the idea of a last week in Jerusalem where he does something in the temple and he ends up being crucified. It seems, you know, a fairly obvious run of events to me. It's the, again, though, I agree that the placing of the cleansing of the temple at the beginning of Jesus' ministry in John has this narrative function. But then the Lazarus story, how would you bring that into the death then? Because it does seem to me too stark ways of explaining the death of Jesus in Jerusalem.
Two contradictory ways, is what you're saying.
I would probably have to go that far, yes. I mean, I guess Richard wouldn't.
Well, I'm suggesting the cleansing of the temple is the initial clash with the Jewish authorities, which then builds up over Jesus' visits to Jerusalem. And of course, John has a last week in Jerusalem, but raising of Lazarus, because you see in John's account, the raising of Lazarus, not surprisingly, has a huge effect on Jesus' popularity with the crowds. So it's a kind of the trigger to this very dangerous popularity of Jesus at the end, which you also get reference to in the synoptics. You know, this sense that Jesus was a troublemaker. They've got to do something about him because, you know, they have a rebellion on their hands, something like that. So that I think the Lazarus event has that effect in John's narrative, and therefore acts as the sort of final point when they must resolve to really take action. And John, of course, has this meeting of the high priest's council after Lazarus' resurrection. Now, the synoptics also have that meeting, but they don't have Lazarus as the kind of trigger for it.
Just time to wrap up, really, as we conclude this section of the programme, with some final thoughts. It's been fascinating going through the various sort of differing points and also the points of, you know, agreement between you gentlemen. I mean, ultimately, when it comes to the authorship of the Gospels as a whole, it sounds to me, James, that you're not disinclined to agree with Richard, that actually we needn't be as sceptical as some have been in your field in the past, that there might be good reasons that Richard's putting forward here for accepting that actually, yes, these were eyewitness accounts that have been transmitted reasonably accurately.
Yeah, I mean, I may be a little agnostic on issues of authorship of Mark, say, and maybe I don't buy the idea of the authorship of John. But yes, I mean, I think the general overall model is a plausible one, particularly with reference to the Synoptic Gospels. I think there's arguments I kind of generally buy, even if I would, you know, be a little sceptical on, you know, absolute precision. But I think it's an important model. I hope people will take it seriously, not just from the conservative wing of scholarship. I know one or two people who aren't from the conservative wing of scholarship who take it seriously, and I think it's moved scholarship forward.
Well, Richard and James will be joining me again next week as we continue to uncover more about this very important book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. We'll be particularly looking at the testimony of the eyewitnesses and how far that should be trusted. What does it constitute when we talk about the testimony of an eyewitness in ancient times? Particularly, we'll be looking at the eyewitness of people like the women at the tomb in regards to the resurrection. Whether eyewitness accounts of miracles count as eyewitness testimony, and that sort of thing. So it'll be a really interesting programme as we conclude this study, this look into Jesus and the eyewitnesses. Don't forget, if you go to the Unbelievable webpage, you can find out more about getting hold of the book. Well worth a read. I found it absolutely fascinating. I'm sure you'll want to read it too. Well worthy of its prize of the Ramsay Prize for Religious Literature. So do check out premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can also download the podcast there. You can also look back over the past archive of programmes. And I look forward to welcoming our guests again at the same time next week. For the moment, it's time to look at some of your feedback to previous week's programming here on the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well,
thank you to the many people who've got in contact over the last few weeks. Many programmes of great interest to many people. Lots of emails coming in. I'm just going to sort of wind up the contact we had from about a month and a half ago, I guess now, but on the issue of healing with Michael Shermer and Adrian Holloway, which provoked a lot of response. Jane, thank you for emailing. You say you recently discovered the show. You live on the west coast of Canada and say a person you might want to look into regarding the so-called healing ministries is Justin Peters. Justin is a pastor in the States. He has cerebral palsy. He's very familiar with the word faith movement and spent much time in his younger years seeking healing for his disease. He has an awesome presentation regarding faith healings. That's at justinpeters.org. And you say you really enjoy the program, greatly appreciate the way views are presented, even though there's often great disagreements between the guests you bring together. Thank you, Jane, for listening. Alan says this is in response to the issue that Michael Shermer brought up about why doesn't God seem to heal amputees? Why do we not have accounts of limbs going back or any, if you like, visual evidence of that? Alan says, I personally have not heard of a limb being recreated, called a creative miracle. However, when Jesus was asked for a great sign, he refused, only offering the sign of Jonah and the whale to this evil and adulterous generation. However, a resurrection from the dead is much more than a creative miracle, assuming that the person was probably dead. And you go on to talk about people such as Don Piper, who apparently has a resurrection story, having been run over by a 40-ton truck, medically proven to be dead. He wrote a book about his 90 minutes in heaven. He didn't even lose much blood for 1.5 hours since his heart did not pump. So there you go. You say he was raised from the dead by prayer, started by a Baptist pastor. You can read his story on YouTube. Thank you, Alan. Interesting. Jason Laurie on that debate between Michael Shermer and Adrian Holloway says, I found it interesting yet very frustrating. With all due respect to Adrian Holloway, he is using subjective experiences to answer a question requiring an objective one. I think Michael is correct that we should be very suspicious of these subjective healings and try our best to come up with the naturalistic answer. For Holloway to respond with, well, don't you think it's good that people feel better after a prayer, is not a Christian answer at all. Christianity is based on evidence, or should be, and we need to apply the same standard to faith and salvation as to miracles. When I come across the Shermers of the world, I simply say that I don't need to prove every miracle, I just need to prove one. Shermer, by the way, has to debunk all of them. I think that was something that Adrian said as well, actually, Jason. But you say, if I can prove just one, then the possibility of the supernatural becomes at least plausible. So thank you very much for your comment. You say, one last point, perhaps Holloway would have been better off to use scripture to answer why God doesn't heal amputees questions. Deuteronomy 6:16 states, do not test the Lord your God. God has no obligation to prove himself to us. Shermer and his followers will soon know the truth. OK, well, thank you very much for getting in touch. Just briefly, here's a phone call from someone with a personal story of healing.
Yeah, Justin. My name's Andrew. I'm 47-year-old from Weston-super-Mare. I went to a new wine festival recently at Shepton Mallet with 25,000 other people. I suffered from a back injury before I went. While I was there, my back injury was healed. I'm in no pain at the moment, thanks to the Lord. I hope this lack of pain will carry on. I've lost 10 years of my life purely by pain. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much for getting in touch. And of course, I'm sure that is a story that could be repeated by many others who believe they have personal testimony. Of course, these things are subjective, inevitably. And that's what I said at the time we recorded that program, that it is inevitably subjective because you have stories where people believe something miraculous has happened. Of course, you can always come up with a possible naturalistic explanation in so many of these cases. But obviously, for many people, they just don't believe that is the case. They believe something supernatural has happened. Really interesting stuff. Moving on, though, to a slightly more recent debate. We had some of your correspondence in regards to Roger and Faith Forster taking on James White a few weeks back on Calvinism and predestination. Miles wanted to weigh on weigh in on that, saying, I'm a listener from the US, I'm a Christian and a regular follower of James White's ministry. I really enjoy your programme. I think yours is one of the rare ones in that you're able to get interfaith dialogues on a regular basis. You say you particularly enjoyed the programmes with James White and the Forsters, and that James White did a good job of showing from Scripture the truthfulness of the doctrines of grace, while I thought the Forsters were arguing more from a philosophical paradigm. In my experience, that's what often happens in a dialogue like this. I also thought the Forsters were a bit condescending towards James White when they couldn't argue their case from Scripture. Despite that, I hope you have James White on more and have more dialogues between Christians that disagree. The forum you provide is an excellent one for that to happen. I thought you did a good job moderating the discussion as well. Take care and God bless. Thank you, Miles. Tim Dar in Newby, I think it's Oklahoma, USA, also wanted to weigh in on this from a different point of view. Says, I've been listening to your show on podcast for several months now and thoroughly enjoyed. I thought that Faith Forster was very insightful when she made the observation that Dr. White's insistence that there is no room for interpretation in the Calvinist-Arminian debate is the logical consequence of his theology. If you believe that you're elected by God for salvation and that your choice has nothing to do with it, as James White does, then it follows that your interpretation of Scripture must be without error. Therefore, anyone who disagrees with you is simply, not simply mistaken, but wrong at best and a heretic at worst. I'm not a Calvinist, but I have the sense and humility to grant that there are verses in the Bible that can be interpreted through a Calvinist lens. I believe in conditional immortality and have been looking forward to that show too. Thank you, Tim. Jason Laurie again, finally, on this issue of predestination. In Surprise, Arizona. What a great name for a place to live. I live in Surprise. Says, I enjoyed the programme last Saturday on Calvinism. Dr. White was consistently reading the passages of John 6, while Roger and Faith had to dance around the Scripture to make their point. Roger and Faith have philosophically, not biblically, tailored a God that suits the needs of man, as opposed to bowing to the sovereign God King of the Bible, who is in complete control of his creation. I think Paul warned Timothy about this very thing when he says in 2 Timothy, "For the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. They will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths." So a variety of responses to that whole issue of predestination and Calvinism. We broadcast that programme, in a sense, to mark the 500th anniversary of the birth of John Calvin. But we moved on to a different topic in our second programme between James White and the Forsters. Again, a Christian discussion, if you like, two different interpretations of hell. James White was defending an eternal conscious torment view of hell, that idea that hell is never ending and those who suffer hell will suffer it in an eternal form. The Whites were defending a view that's been called conditional immortality, that only those who put their trust in Jesus or accept the free gift of life from Jesus have immortality, and that hell, therefore, or whatever it is and however people get to it, is something that is not eternal. There is an end to it. There is an end to people who reject God. So a number of responses again to this one. Let's hear some of your views by phone. This was what you called in to tell us about that particular debate.
Just listening to this debate relating to eternal punishment, I kind of get the impression that he seems to think punishment is not an eternal thing. I think in the book of Revelation it says that the devil and his angels will be tortured day and night in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb. And from what we understand of Revelation, I think we also conclude that basically anyone else who's rejected Christ, that the place of punishment is also for them as well. Now, if it's day and night in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb, where the devil and his angels will be tortured, day and night does seem to imply that it's actually ongoing and unceasing.
Good evening, Justin. It's Relinda. I was quite interested in your program when your guests were discussing hell. There is a book called Heaven is So Real by Chu Thomas. There is a chapter on a place called hell where Jesus actually took her to hell and she saw her relatives there and what hell is all about. There are also some other people who have been to hell, like the man who was stung by the jellyfish, and there's another chap in Nigeria who died and went to hell and heaven as well. But in the book of Revelations 20, 13 to 15, it says, "The sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one according to his works. Then death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death, and anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire." So I think it's very interesting for people to really know about hell.
James from Glasgow. Hello. I would like to ask a question for Unbelievable, please, about hell. The parable of Jesus making a difference between the sheep and the goats not appear sometimes as a metaphor, you know, in the regeneration of the relationship between the Trinity of Christ and the Father with ourselves. How would James Watt or your speakers resonate with this? Is it a metaphor about the sheep and the goats? What do you think?
Well, thank you for those comments. It's been really interesting to get your views on this one as well. Not an easy subject to talk about in many ways. This one from Colin, an email, says, "Your two discussions between James White and the Forsters highlight that depending on how you interpret scripture, you end up with two very different concepts of God. On the one hand, you have a God who seems to loathe humanity, but as a concession decides to save a few lucky people, at the same time allowing more babies to be born, knowing that most of them will end up as fuel for his everlasting torture chamber. On the other hand, you have a God who cares for every person born into the world and desires them to come into a loving relationship with him. Which God would you rather spend eternity with?" says Colin. And just time possibly for one more. Pauli says, "I continue to enjoy your show. Last week's topic was not in a sense very enjoyable, but it's still something that's worth thinking about. I've noticed recently that issues related to hell are very high on the list of typical objections that atheists have to Christianity. So clear thinking on this matter is something that should not be neglected. Even though I'm not a Calvinist, I respect much of James White's work and might even call myself his fan to some extent. With regard to the nature of hell, I'm somewhat undecided, but lean towards James's view in that I think it's more probable that hell is everlasting. At the same time, I don't think that the issue is quite so clear as some think it is, and thus it was good to hear from both sides of the debate. Here's some more or less random thoughts on the matter. Most people would consider the death penalty to be ethically more questionable form of punishment than imprisonment for life. Just hypothetically, if the quality of life in hell would be comparable to life in prison, would it be in any sense obvious that everlasting hell would be morally objectionable, whereas annihilation wouldn't be? It's a very interesting way of putting it, though I would assume that whatever hell is, it's probably infinitely worse than being in prison in a kind of, you know, in the UK or something. James made the point that the major torment that the damned are experiencing in hell may be that they are being kept from expressing their hatred of God. I wonder if Faith and Roger are willing to accept this premise, because if they are, I think that one can add a few other premises that could reasonably be taken to imply the everlasting existence of the inhabitants of hell. These premises would be: the state of existence that the damned are in is something that grieves God. God would allow the damned to go out of existence, would even see this as desirable, and God will respect the free choices of the damned. From these premises, one could argue that God leaves the choice between continued existence in hell and annihilation to the inhabitants of hell themselves. And given that they're willing to express their hatred of God but are limited in their ability to do so, could it not be that they continue to choose to exist in hell for the reason that they know this will cause grief to God? Very interesting arguments, but I haven't come across those at all, Pauli, and I don't know if anyone else has any suggestions to put there to Pauli, but some interesting ways of looking at the whole area. So thank you for your contributions. Thanks to everyone who's been getting in contact over the last few weeks in regard to the programme. Last week we were talking about happiness, does being a Christian, does religion make people unhappy? That was Barry Duke and Tom Price. I'll read out some of your responses to that next week. But just to say, I've started a thread on the Premier community, the Unbelievable group there, in response to that programme. So do check that out if you'd like to respond to that particular issue, or indeed any of the others that have been coming up in the programme today. You're more than welcome to start a conversation yourself there. Just go to the Unbelievable webpage, as usual, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Click on the link through to the Premier community. Join up, the place where lots of Christians and non-Christians get together to chat on a regular basis. I'd be delighted to have you as part of that group. And don't forget that web address, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Also the place for all your apologetic needs when it comes to these discussion programmes. A vast back catalogue that you can look at there. You can subscribe to the podcast. You can get information on the latest programmes, particularly obviously today in regard to the book we've been discussing, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. It's all there, and we welcome your comments by email and phone as well. So do get in touch, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and you can phone 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. It's wonderful that we've had lots of new people joining the programme recently. If you're a new listener to the programme, why not tell me where you're from, how you got listening, and what you think about what we're doing here. Great to have you with me today. Let me tell you what's coming up at the same time next week. You're unbelievable. Well, it's a second bite of the cherry for Richard Borkham and James Crossley. They're back to continue debating and discussing Richard's eye-opening book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, winner of the Ramsey Prize this year. It has really shaken up the New Testament scholarship when it comes to the veracity, the authenticity of the Gospels as far as they're conveying eyewitness accounts of the life of Jesus. We'll be hearing more of Richard's arguments in that direction at the same time next week. We'll be looking at the eyewitness testimony itself. How strongly can that be counted on for its accuracy? What about claims of eyewitnesses to miracles and things like that? That's something James Crossley has a problem with. Join me again at the same time for another fascinating discussion on the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. Unbelievable. See you at the same time next week.